Today on Wings, Women and Food Sovereignty with Beverly Bell.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Beverly Bell is the organizational coordinator of Other Worlds, a women-driven education and movement-building collaborative of paid and volunteer organizers, activists, writers, artists, intellectuals, and students that worked in indigenous and campesino coalitions, research institutions, and grassroots networks. The mission of Other Worlds is to document and educate about alternative models of social and economic relations. Beverly Bell is also the author of Birthing Justice, Women Creating Economic and Social Alternatives, and co-author with Tori Field of Harvesting Justice, Transforming Food, Land, and Agricultural Systems in the Americas. I'm Kelly L. Ramirez Watson. On March 5th, 2014, I sat down with Beverly Bell at the office of Food First in Oakland, California, for a discussion of harvesting justice and the issue of food sovereignty. We began with Bell describing the books Birthing Justice and Harvesting Justice and the relationship between them.
Birthing Justice is a book of interviews of 12 remarkable women around the world, each of whom is part of an extraordinary global movement for social, economic, and or gender justice. So the women tell in their own words what they are doing as women within the movement, the role of gender within the movement, and in society at large, and then how their movement is actually creating transformation. Part of it is preserving ancient traditions, whereby people are more important than profit and community is more important than commodity. There is absolutely an overlap with harvesting justice. Harvesting justice looks at more than 100 case studies of the transformation of food, land, and agricultural systems in the Americas. And some of the women from Birthing Justice are also part of that story and that movement.
What is food sovereignty?
Food sovereignty goes beyond food security. Food security says that everyone should have enough to eat. But actually, if you live in the global south and you are the victim of corporate dumping of U.S. taxpayer-paid agribusiness commodities, you might have enough to eat, but you certainly wouldn't have food sovereignty. In fact, agriculture in your country might have been ravaged, would likely have been ravaged by this dumping. So food sovereignty, on the other hand, requires that everyone has enough to eat, but it's also concerned with every aspect of how that food is produced and distributed. It's about the livelihoods and the quality of life of food producers and farmers, fishers, ranchers, farm workers, really everybody in the food supply chain. It also looks at how farming affects the earth. So, for example, the way that people treat the land and the oceans. It has to take into account how international trade policies affect farmers around the world, because that's a huge element. So, really, I think that we could say that at its root, food sovereignty is about people having the power to define and create the food systems of which they are a part. Not corporations, not elite governments. It's really about democratizing our food system.
We're getting corporate food all over the world. We're getting health problems because of it. And some movements I know are into, well, what did our ancestors eat? Food sovereignty would help them with that if they want it.
Absolutely. So food sovereignty says that everyone has the right to produce locally food for local consumption. Locally might mean your tomato garden, the produce of which you are then going to take down to the farmer's market. But really, this problem is such that it can't only be about backyard gardeners or CSA farmers.
CSA means community-supported agriculture.
Food sovereignty looks at the global trade systems, because that's what is screwing agriculture and, in fact, ramping up hunger around the world. through land grabs, through undermining local domestic production, through the massive exportation of GMO crops and other toxic chemicals that are used on seeds that destroy local seed stocks. All of those elements are pieces of it. And so food sovereignty blends what might be called food justice, which is looking at the race and class and sometimes gender element of local food systems. It takes into account traditional and indigenous food systems. It looks at people's ability to grow as locally as they can, but then it also incorporates, by necessity, the global structures. So, for example, the World Bank and the World Trade Organization have played a horrible role in terms of undermining agriculture around the world. So food sovereignty activists also have to look at the international trade and financial institutions as well. When I say food sovereignty activists, of course, it doesn't mean that every person has to do that. You might be a farmer, Kelly, and you would be contributing to food sovereignty, but there have to be people looking at all of the elements to make up the movement.
So how have corporations interfered with food sovereignty?
Corporations, often, again, subsidized by us, by U.S. taxpayers, have been responsible for destroying local production and domestic production around the world, especially in global South countries. I'll just give you the example of Haiti, which is a country where I have worked for 35 years. After the earthquake in Haiti, among the many disgusting disaster profiteers who jumped up and down and salivated and went zinging into Washington to get contracts from what was supposed to be aid for the Haitian people, but many of which largely instead went to corporate contracts. Among them were a lot of agribusiness corporations, notably those who had been given contracts in Arkansas by our fine ex-president, Bill Clinton. And so they immediately got contracts to begin dumping food in Haiti. Well, you can say in the case of a catastrophe, it's very good to have disaster aid, and people were certainly hungry. And yet it's been done in such a way that did not protect local production. Many peasant farmers in Haiti said to me, we can still grow food. The rural areas, in fact, were not hit by the earthquake of 2010. But what has happened instead is that this agribusiness has come in. It can sell at cheaper prices than Haitian farmers because it grows at economy of scale, and also, again, it's subsidized by taxpayers, which peasant production in Haiti is not. And so especially rice farmers can no longer afford to grow and have gone out of business in droves. And just on this point of Haiti, the earthquake in Haiti was extraordinary in terms of its death toll. In a country of 9 million people, up to 300,000, we don't know the exact number, but up to 300,000 were killed. And it was a 7.0 earthquake on the Richter scale. A few weeks later, in Chile, there was a 7.4 scale earthquake, and only 600 and something people died. Now, why is this? In fact, you can draw a direct line from International Monetary Fund food policies and that death toll. Now you might say, wait, what? But what happened was that the IMF pushed two standby agreements on the Haitian government in the 80s and 90s, and one of the conditions of those agreements was that the Haitian government had to drop their tariffs. That is, they had to drop protection on domestic imports. And so exporters from the U.S. and elsewhere were suddenly able to only pay a very, very tiny percentage of taxes to the Haitian government for exporting their food. Well, immediately, I mean literally almost overnight, Haitian farmers found themselves competing with huge amounts, again, especially of rice, being dumped into the country, and so they went out of business in droves. Hundreds of thousands of those peasant farmers fled their failed farms, either for other countries or for the capital, where they, you know, began working as sweatshop workers or vendors on the street or whatever. But because they were so poor, they could not afford adequate housing. So they had to live, many of them, in very shoddy housing, built in very shoddy and insecure locales. And that was the largest cause of the death, was those substandard houses collapsing on people at the time of the earthquake.
People in Haiti had to eat cookies that are made of a certain type of soil. And the pregnant women especially get certain nutrients from them. But it's basically literally mud pies. Have you heard of that?
Oh, yes, I've heard of them and seen them. They're mud pies. And this is what is so sick. Jean Ziegler, who is the former UN Special Rapporteur on the Right of Food, said, quote, "Every child who dies from hunger is assassinated." What he meant by that was that every one of those deaths could have been prevented because there's enough food in the world to feed 12 billion people, and yet there are only 7 billion on the planet. So the hunger that we see in Haiti with people eating mud pies and the hunger that we see elsewhere around the world is neither natural nor inevitable. In fact, it is the result of policy choices. And as depressing as that is on one level, that actually gives me great hope, because what it means is that different policies can yield different outcomes.
As long as climate change doesn't wreck it up, right?
As long as climate change doesn't wreck it up, but even with climate change, we have the potential, we as a global citizenry, to live in a world that is much more humane and where fewer babies and young children and pregnant women and others have to die of unnecessary hunger.
The United States, and that's now been a few years ago, said that there is no human right to food. There is only the opportunity to buy food. That was the U.S. position on this. What do you think of that?
Well, it doesn't surprise me, and I laugh because it is just so perverse and so sick. And the U.S. is, I believe, one of the few countries in the world that hasn't passed the UN Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Of course, the right to food is a fundamental human right. It is as fundamental as the right to be free from torture. In fact, it's more fundamental because one thing that unites every one of us on the planet, we all eat. And if anyone is without the right to food, well, we might as well just lay down and die. We've already lost the goal. If we cannot all work to sustain ourselves as one teeny tiny little planet with one large and connected, interconnected human family, what's the point of any of it?
To what extent do people in food movements practice gift economy, especially as it relates to food?
Oh my goodness. Across the world, I think that food has traditionally been viewed as something that belonged to the family, belonged to the community. We certainly see it in the U.S. in different ways because gift economy still exists here. We just don't have the right lenses on to see it. Of course, it's been a lot more beaten down by capitalism. But the story of Thanksgiving today, I mean, obviously, traditionally, it was about another form of theft of Native people's land and food. But the idea that little children are taught as early as nursery of sharing food, that's key. You know, we still prize feeding people when they show up at our house. But I would say that much more than in this country, with its modernity and idea of scarcity and such, all over the world, food is considered a community good. And there are many cultures where you never go to a political meeting without there being food. You never go to a person's house without immediately being told to please sit down and eat first, and then we will talk later. In Iraq, if someone shows up at your house, you are obligated to feed that person for 3 days. And then, I've been told by Iraqis, then you say, what is your name and why did you come here? In fact, it still exists in a lot of countries in just remarkable ways. Even places that don't have enough food will share, because that's the nature of survival. So gift economies have actually been one of the ways that people have avoided starvation around the world. You don't have money today, so your kids are hungry. There happened to be a harvest of what I was growing in my back garden, and so I would just, without even thinking of it, even if I don't know you in many countries, would come over with the bag of food for your little ones. And then you will not necessarily return it to me, but pass it on down the line, pass it forward. So gift economies really underscore the same values, actually, that food justice and food sovereignty hold. And it's a beautiful question that you ask, because I think at the center of gift economies and actually at the center of community sharing is food.
How powerful is the picture that corporations put out to especially third world places like Haiti? You need investment by foreign corporations or you'll always be backward, and you need to make the foreign investors feel secure. So you have to basically, I think the saying, give up your way of life. You have to turn everything over to what the investors want. How powerful an argument are they making there?
Well, I don't actually really think it's about the persuasive power of their argument. I think it is about the hard power, pressure of the United States government, other Western governments, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, all of which have ways to force low-income countries to accept a lot of this, even though the countries may know that it is in opposition to the well-being of their citizenry. Now, they might not care about their citizenry. Most countries don't. But even governments that do care, that have cared, have felt a lot of pressure to give in to this corporate trade.
Which then brings me to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I know that even with it not yet in effect, that the nation of Peru has been under tremendous pressure, as you put it, to pay a huge amount, billions of dollars, to a corporation because Peru said, you're polluting this region with your oil and the people are getting sick and the mining and the people are getting sick and we want you to stop. And they sued Peru for loss of profit. This NAFTA on steroids TPP would really see that ramped up. So how will that affect food sovereignty if it's passed?
Well, it will be extremely detrimental, just as you say, Kelia. It's yet another example of a trade pact that has been negotiated with very unequal terms. So the low-income countries have not had the power to stand up against the U.S. and others who are pushing it. We don't always read about this in the paper, but there are often a lot of threats that are made to smaller countries, to poorer countries, for fighting back on these. And there are all sorts of forms of arm twisting that go on behind the scenes. And certainly with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, there are a lot, and the end result will be the same thing. It will be loss of sovereignty. It will be loss of food sovereignty. It will be loss of income for a lot of local producers, farmers, and others.
Helena Norberg-Hodge produced the documentary, The Economics of Happiness. She emphasizes localization as the key, especially in food. Are people in the developed world ready to deal with localization in the face of globalization?
Well, the governments aren't, but citizens are. People all over, as we certainly know in the U.S., are going back to their gardens. There is just an enormous burgeoning of urban gardens starting all over, including in Oakland, where we're sitting now, in West Oakland, where there's not one supermarket there, or was not one until the community started one. There has been a large growth in local gardens that's happening in so-called food deserts all over. We are seeing CSAs and farmers markets ramp up in extraordinary numbers, and we are seeing more local farmers able to survive because of these partnerships with CSAs and farmers markets. We are seeing the spread of organic farming, of non-GMO farming. We are seeing a great big movement of people localizing their food. You know, even Whole Foods now finally has started sourcing local food. So the people certainly understand that. Movements everywhere, grassroots organizations and community groups don't want our food controlled by the industry, controlled by agribusiness. So that's what's very cool, is that all over the world, people are engaging in this. In many places, they never stopped. Indigenous groups and campesino communities around the world are growing the food locally as they always have, if it hasn't been smushed yet by these larger forces. Now, the governments, especially the wealthy governments, are the challenge to that, and that's where we have to push back with an organized movement that is very political in nature.
I looked at your website and I noticed a curriculum, and I was wondering, what did you put together and is it being widely adopted?
The book Harvesting Justice has an accompanying curriculum, as you say, called Sowing Seeds. And it's very cool. It's written for people of all different ages. It has everything from participatory games to educational projects to political actions that people can take. We think it has been widely adopted, but we don't track it exactly because it's available to be downloaded for free by anybody. And so we have no idea how much it's spread. We hope very far.
Have you heard from any teachers?
Yes. We know that college professors are using it. A lot of organized groups, like some of the local Via Campesina groups, like national agriculture support groups, small farmer support groups, and very cool food justice groups are using both the curriculum as well as the book Harvesting Justice.
Are women leading in the food sovereignty movement in general?
Women don't always have the opportunity to surge to the front of the organizations that are working on food sovereignty, but in some places they do have a very strong voice. I would actually say that more importantly, traditionally, the keepers of food sovereignty and the keepers of seeds and seed sovereignty around the world have always been women. Women are certainly by far the most engaged in food production overall, but then what I have found is that each culture has its own division of labor between those who plant the food, those who harvest the food, those who take it to market, those who ensure that there is food for the family on the table, and it looks differently in different places.
Food sovereignty activists involve themselves in a variety of political issues that at first blush do not seem to be related to food. Bell explained the relatedness of the various issues by citing the multifaceted work of Via Campesina.
Via Campesina, which means peasant's way or small farmer's way, is the international organization that is at the forefront of pushing for food sovereignty. In fact, Via Campesina is a coalition of dozens and dozens of groups of small farmers, women farmers, indigenous farmers, fisher people, and others who are promoting food sovereignty. And I'm happy to say Via Campesina has started a commission for zero tolerance against violence, period. So that means especially violence against women and children, but they're looking at it across the board. What's been cool about this is that originally the commission was only comprised of women, and this was just viewed as a women's issue. But now the men have really embraced it, and half of the members of the commission are men, and men at all different levels have really taken this up. So to me, that's a beautiful example of how, if we are going to look at food sovereignty, we also have to look at healthy societies. And of course, that has to have zero tolerance against violence against women and children.
You know, how are corporations making inroads into indigenous values, and what are the food sovereignty movements doing against that?
The corporations are impacting indigenous peoples profoundly. So, of course, capitalism is premised on growth. If you look, many places around the world have already had their natural resources destroyed or plundered. Where do you find the greatest repository of virgin forests and of unpolluted rivers and of unexploited land? It's on indigenous people's territories. And so what we are seeing all over the world is that indigenous peoples have a giant bullseye painted on them. And this is one of the truly great crimes of modernity. The same genocide that happened back to 500 years ago in the U.S. with the conquest by the Spanish, we are seeing all over the world against indigenous peoples. For example, I work a lot with indigenous organizations of Lenca and Garifuna people in Honduras. And there is a literal war going on. Only one side is armed, and that, of course, is the government. and the goons who are backed by the corporations. On the other hand, what you have are indigenous peoples who are simply trying to live on their land and defend their sacred waters and territories from being taken from them. As a result, they are being killed, they are being tortured, they are being disappeared, they are being arrested. We see the same sort of attack on indigenous defenders all over the world, and we see land being mined and logged and dammed and otherwise exploited for the benefit of corporations everywhere.
Better wages for food producers, especially the farm workers who harvest the crops, is a daunting issue for the food sovereignty movement. But there have been victories in this area. One case involves the Immokalee tomato pickers.
The Coalition of Immokalee Workers is a group of farm workers out of the town of Immokalee, Florida, who have convinced so many multinational corporations to double the wages that they pay to tomato pickers. And I'm talking most recently Walmart. I actually cried when I read that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which is like 50 or so mainly undocumented Latino, totally disrespected, and in some ways powerless human beings, actually beat the world's largest corporation. Just as a parenthetical, if that is true, we can do anything. We should remember that. The corporations for a long time said, oh no, we can't possibly double wages for tomatoes picked, because then that will push the price up to the consumer. Certainly, there is so much profit going to a Wendy's, going to McDonald's, going to a Walmart, that they don't even feel it. So that's also another element, Kelly, of food sovereignty, are the wages that are paid to those who work in the food chain. Because if we have a system that does not respect them and it does not recognize the work that they're doing with adequate rights and wages, just like having hungry people, we've really lost the battle.
So are these food sovereignty movements in contact with people who are concerned with things like peak oil, freshwater shortages, climate change, and other resource limits, and have they considered how these issues will affect food production?
Oh, absolutely. What is very, very wonderful about this political moment is that a lot of movements that have been separated up until now, indigenous movements struggling here, environmental justice and climate change movements struggling here, food groups struggling over here, the interconnectedness of all of it is becoming more and more clear with the environmental backlash and with the destruction of and commodification of basically everything by profiteers, by global capitalism. More and more people are coming together and making common cause, and that is really where hope lies.
You have been listening to Beverly Bell, organizational coordinator of the collaborative called Other Worlds, talking about food sovereignty. The book, Harvesting Justice, and its companion curriculum, Sowing Seeds, are available as free PDFs and by sliding scale for hard copies of the book at the website otherworldsarepossible.org. That's otherworldsarepossible, all one word, .org. Bell's latest book, Fault Lines, Views Across Haiti's Divide, can also be ordered through the Other Worlds site. For Wings, I'm Kelia Ramirez Watson in Oakland, California.
To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org and check our daily women's news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.